Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
On television and in the movies, spy thrillers continue to fascinate in uncertain times.
Have you heard of Operation Blackfriar? I'm going to get my head around this and type it up. I'll see you Thursday. Okay.
In the film The Bourne Ultimatum, a journalist from The Guardian arrives back at London Airport and phones his editor with a hot story about high-level corruption in the US intelligence community. Naturally, his call is monitored by the spooks in America.
I have a hit on Echelon, Blackfriar. I repeat, Blackfriar. Looks like it's coming from a European signal. NSA, please confirm your receipt. Open up the frequency reports.
Sir, what you got?
We intercepted a call in London. Keyword, Blackfriar.
Okay, send it to New York right away.
If you could see the images of the data monitoring rooms of the CIA, you'd notice that some of the people have a green badge and some have a blue badge. Blue is for government employees. Green is for private contractors.
Our target is a British national, Simon Ross, a reporter. I want all his phones, his BlackBerry, his apartment, his car, bank accounts, credit cards, travel patterns. I want to know what he's going to think before he does. Every dirty little secret he has.
This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, and I'm Stan Correy. The green and blue badges are clues to a paradigm shift inside the most powerful intelligence networks in the world. The private, for-profit companies are moving in. In America, it's a highly contentious issue. If the spook has responsibility towards the bottom line, as well as the national interest, which one takes priority? It's a looming debate in Australia too. Here you may have noticed there are lots of ads for good people to try for jobs in ASIO. Here's one that was on the radio recently, which began by asking people what they most love.
I'd say my house.
Oh, a shopping spree.
Seeing my team win.
A new car.
My job. Maybe a manicure.
What you're listening to is a recruitment ad, broadcast on commercial radio in recent months.
We asked these people what fulfillment means to them. Did you spot the ASIO intelligence analyst?
Well, did you?
With ASIO, you get to see the bigger picture, develop your skills, and reach your potential. There's nothing more fulfilling than that.
Join ASIO and really love your job. Australian intelligence agencies, like those in America, are not only having trouble getting enough of the right people to join up, but also in keeping them once they're trained. They leave and join the private intelligence companies. A report by a parliamentary committee on intelligence and security put it this way in 2007.
One agency described the substantial intake of inexperienced staff into the organisation in this way. We have a staffing bulge that looks a bit like a laboratory flask in terms of experience.
The actual names of the agencies are classified, but the problem is widespread. Elsewhere, the report says it's not only that the agencies are bottom-heavy with new recruits, but these recruits haven't yet got much experience.
Another agency noted that growth within the agency has resulted in a workforce which now comprises younger managers and supervisors, lacking the decision-making experience of staff members with more time in the workforce.
The trend in the US now is that intelligence officers who have experience and security clearance get recruited by consulting firms who specialise in defence and intelligence work. Then, a bit later, they may go back into government work at much higher pay. This revolving door from public to private to public and perhaps back again has its own name. It's called bidding back. In this process, there's a great danger of the government losing its control over who knows what and what information is used for. America's government auditor, the GAO, has repeatedly warned this year about loss of control over decision-making in intelligence analysis. The interplay between public and private intelligence is a feature of a current political thriller on the ABC, The State Within.
Luke left these too. Copy the contract. It appears CMC wasn't employed directly by Usman. They were actually working for the Armitage Corporation. Firstly, to protect Armitage assets in Tyrgyzstan. Secondly, to provide special military advisors to the government of President Usman. For special advisors, read hired killers. Oh, the punchline's over the page. Look at the signatures at the bottom. For CMC, Colonel Charles McIntyre. On behalf of the Armitage Corporation, the then CEO, Lynn Warner. Nasty, isn't it?
In this program, Lynn Warner was the CEO of the private military intelligence company Armitage, but she's now the US Secretary of Defense, and the plot gets very thick indeed. The action is fast-paced, choppy edits, suicide bombers destroying planes, private military companies smuggling weapons, regime change, secret bugging of politicians and diplomats. It is, of course, fiction. But in real life, there are also some amazing things. Take, for example, something that happened in Wall Street in May. The biggest private equity fund in the world, the Carlyle Group, bought the government consulting division of a company called Booz Allen Hamilton.
Carlyle Group plunges back into the military business. I'm Dennis Berman, columnist with the Wall Street Journal, here to talk about Carlyle's big investment and Booz Allen Hamilton's government consulting business. Wherever one turns in Washington, Booz Allen happens to be there, consulting on a big military purchasing contract, consulting government officials on intelligence matters. Booz Allen is a part of the very fabric of the national security infrastructure. Of course, that's probably why Carlyle sees such a fine investment opportunity.
On the streets, Booz Allen Hamilton is called the Shadow CIA because its government division does so much private intelligence work for the US government. They are, in effect, spies for hire, and that's the name of a new book by Tim Shorrock.
It's important to remember that Booz Allen is a private company, privately held, and Carlyle, of course, is a privately held company. And so these are companies that don't have to report much information to the Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates the public markets here. And so they can do a lot of what they plan in more or less within corporate secrecy. They don't have to, you know, announce their plans or talk about much of their future. They'll just go about their business and announce their deals when they make them. So I think we're going to see Carlyle putting in a fair amount of capital into this company, probably acquiring other powerful companies and making Booz Allen even bigger.
The Carlyle Group bought Booz Allen for $2.5 billion. One recent investor in Carlyle, who put money into the company only last year, is the sovereign wealth fund of Abu Dhabi, one of the richest states in the Arabian Gulf. No wonder the conspiracy theorists can have a field day with these kinds of wheels within wheels. The Carlyle Group knows that the business of intelligence is a growth area. Tim Shorrock.
The reason I think it's significant is for two reasons. One, Booz Allen Hamilton is one of the largest and one of the most important of the U.S. intelligence contractors. They're involved at very high levels of U.S. national intelligence, from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, where they provide some management and consulting services, to agencies like the National Security Agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, the agency that handles imagery and mapping for the Pentagon and other intelligence agencies. They're providing very high-level analysis as well as helping integrate information across intelligence agency lines. So they're a very big player in the intelligence community.
The fact that such a big player in private intelligence has been sold is highly significant. But then there's the issue of who's bought it.
Fact is, they're being picked up by the Carlyle Group, which people who've been following current events know is a very well-connected private equity firm, the largest in the world. And in the past, they've had advice from people like former President George H.W. Bush, former Secretary of State James Baker. Those people have left the company, but there's still many key players there that are former high-ranking government officials.
Booz Allen's management consulting company works in Australia too, and they also do a lot of consulting work for the Australian government. Previously, Booz Allen Hamilton was a single company with two divisions, a government division and a business division. Carlyle has bought the government division, and the now separate business division has been renamed Booz & Co. Strangely, in Australia, the two divisions have not been separated, and the new Booz & Co. here will still be doing government business, and defence and security will be part of their consultancy. In a press release, Booz & Co. in Australia said,
"We'll retain close working links with the US government-focused Booz Allen Hamilton."
The connections with the new Carlyle-owned company will need to be maintained. The government business, especially defence and security, is far too profitable to let go. In Australia, as far back as 2005, the head of Booz Allen in Australia told his staff in an in-house magazine,
"The Canberra business continues to grow and grow and grow."
Since 2005, Booz Allen have been regularly recruiting staff out of the government defence and intelligence agencies and doing a lot of work for the federal government. A lot of what they do is confidential because it comes under the National Security Code. Here's how they describe their Australian expertise on their website.
Booz Allen has a unique reputation and capacity for delivering against the needs of clients in the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance and electronic warfare domain. We have accredited top secret personnel and facilities for conducting this work within the Booz Allen premises.
And also in the same document,
Booz Allen has a long history of providing support to major national security, intelligence and law enforcement agencies for the use and protection of vital information. Our areas of expertise in the strategic security domain include public sector mission effectiveness, policy analysis and planning, decision support, systems engineering and technical assistance, intelligence analysis.
You can find the full list of Booz Allen's Australian expertise in defence and security on Background Briefing's website. Last year, Booz Allen got paid $375,000 for telling the Defence Department that soldiers' combat boots were substandard. As one newspaper report put it, this was something soldiers already knew. Booz Allen also has a current contract with the Attorney General's Department, the department with responsibility for ASIO. The contract wasn't directly to do with ASIO, but it's definitely related to collecting intelligence. The contract was for
investigation of new and emerging telecommunications technologies for application to Telecommunications Interception and Access Act 1979.
A spokesman for Booz & Co. in Australia told Background Briefing that while they retain close links with the US defence and intelligence business, that there is a different approach here. They told us that intelligence outsourcing on the American model was not that prevalent here, and that they didn't engage in any direct intelligence or defence work, but only give advice, and that they see themselves as thought leaders. At issue here is whether or not some aspects of government are only the business of government. That is, the phrase goes, they are, quote, inherently governmental. Farming them out to the private sector, usually in the name of efficiency, is not in the national interest, and governments risk, and this is a quote, losing accountability and control over analysis and policy making. There's a website called The Spy Who Billed Me by political scientist Dr. R.J. Hillhouse. She first looks at the smaller private companies.
The typical small private intelligence corporation has hired former CIA case officers and other CIA personnel to basically ply their trade, but for the private sector. For example, a small corporation, which is probably a $100 million corporation, $200 million corporation, does non-official cover identities for the CIA. In other words, when a CIA officer or now contractor would be working as a a spy in a foreign country and needs a different identity, they will do the background creating, the fake credit history, fake social security numbers and identity papers for them to be able to cover them. That's done in the private sector. That company also does some counterintelligence, counterterrorist work. Small corporations provide service that do basically anything that the CIA does.
Then there are the mega defense contractors and the bigger intelligence companies, often called the body shops in the industry.
The large companies as well, the large multinationals, such as Raytheon, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, are major intelligence contractors throughout the intelligence community for the National Security Agency as well as CIA, Defense Intelligence, CSC, Booz Allen Hamilton, also one of the major prime contractors, and SAIC.
Dr. Hillhouse also spoke about the unusual recruitment methods of some intelligence contractors.
They were recruiting people who would actually quit working on the CIA one day, and the next day they would come back at nearly a third more in pay, doing the exact same job, sitting in the same desk, but the color of their badge had changed from the government blue to contractor green, and the companies were called to task up on the seventh floor of CIA headquarters and told not to recruit there anymore. And interestingly enough, a friend noticed that shortly after that, CIA contracts started carrying a clause in them that prohibited the company contracting from recruiting employees on government property.
These brazen examples of headhunting government intelligence workers didn't stop there.
I would hear from people who are retiring, or as soon as they'd started announcing or talking to friends that they were going to retire, their email box would be full of solicitations to come join various companies because everyone was shorthanded and there isn't a supply out in the private sphere. So they were losing people, so that the average person at the CIA right now, the majority of people at the CIA have less than 5 years' experience. It's very much young people running. You've got nothing in the middle. You've got the new guys who've been recruited, and they're having a big hard time retaining them, and then a few older at the top, and everyone else is contractors. It is, at this point, probably over 70% contractors, the staff of the CIA.
In the early days, the private companies mostly had government work associated with the hardware, supplying and setting up the IT networks and so on, from desktops to satellites. Then the work started to become as much analysing the data that was being collected on that hardware. From New York University, Simon Chesterman.
Where privatisation of the collection of intelligence involves, for example, allowing telecommunications companies significant discretion in how they collect information, that's very troubling. Or when it involves paying contractors to interrogate people, that's also problematic. In terms of the privatisation of this second category of analysis, again, there are problems of conflict of interest. You are effectively, depending on how critical your government policymakers are, you are handing over a significant part of the policy process to private actors, which raises obvious concerns.
The blurring of public and private has been a constant source of friction for politicians, bureaucrats and lawyers. Handing over what are inherently government functions in intelligence services raises myriad problems. Simon Chesterman.
The secrecy question becomes exacerbated. It's partly the necessary secrecy of this type of activity, but also there's at least some anecdotal evidence that this isn't simply being kept secret because of operational concerns, but precisely to avoid scrutiny. And so there are some examples, in particular in the United States, of outsourcing of intelligence activities as a way of the government maintaining plausible deniability.
What Simon Chesterman means by plausible deniability is that the government can say its hands are clean, because whatever happened was done by people under private contract. Often that contract has in it clauses which say private employees are not responsible to government regulations on, for example, the rules of war. This issue of maintaining accountability is getting increasing traction in the US. In Australia, similar ideas are beginning to emerge. One of Australia's best-known experts on the intelligence community is Ian Wing.
I think it will first be noticed when large numbers of consulting personnel come in for slightly longer periods and they start to be part of the furniture.
These people have access to very high-level, top-secret intelligence information, and they take it with them when they leave.
It'll become quite commercial at that point, especially when people will be walking out the door with their top-secret clearance and walking back in the following week earning an extra 50 grand.
Yes, what the Americans call bidding back, I believe.
Indeed.
Yes, that process of bidding back, if things develop along the American model, that could occur here in Australia.
It's already occurring.
Right, so it's already occurring because intelligence officers are at a premium in the market.
Well, it's already occurring across government in other areas, specifically, let's say, in defence procurements, where experienced defence personnel can leave the department and return to work as part of consulting organisations on major projects, and we see that all the time. Intelligence has been somewhat quarantined, I think because it has been small and specialised, and maybe the body shops didn't see the value for money in going after the intelligence area. But now, with the war against terrorism, they can see it as a good money spinner, and they'll be putting their people in as hard as they can.
Ian Wing firmly believes all consultants should at least be Australian citizens and hold Australian security clearances. The companies, too, should be Australian and not a branch of a multinational.
I see a potential problem. I mean, I've raised this issue with colleagues and they say, oh, but of course it's fine if the foreign companies are based in London or Washington, D.C., because we're all allies. Well, that may be true, and I think we are good allies. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Australia agrees with absolutely everything that the United States and absolutely everything that Great Britain does. I think we are independent countries and we need an independent intelligence assessment capability.
Ian Wing, who's now Associate Professor of the Australian Graduate School of Policing in Canberra. Another former senior intelligence officer who says we should be more independent is Sandy Gordon.
We take much of our intelligence from the so-called cousins, who are fundamentally the UK, the US, Canada, and to a lesser extent, New Zealand. The outsourcing issue for us, therefore, becomes what sort of outsourcing do they engage in, particularly the US? I don't think Australian intelligence agencies are heavily involved in outsourcing in that primary collection and analysis role themselves, but they're heavily dependent on the US, which may be dependent on outsourcing, and that obviously impacts on the overall quality of the product. And at the same time, being one step removed, it becomes more difficult for us to put ourselves in that position of asking the fundamental question, who's providing the information and what might be their motive in doing so?
Sandy Gordon. He's worked for the ONA, the Office of National Assessments, and was Director of Intelligence for the Australian Federal Police in the late 1990s. The question of motives he raises is deeply intertwined with the murky and secret world of international politics, much of which will never be publicly known, or at least not for decades. One which has become well known and now notorious is the work of how some intelligence is collected, that is, the process of interrogation of prisoners. Information about rendition of prisoners to foreign countries, torture and even debates about what is torture have been surfacing for some years. Only a few weeks ago, the FBI's Inspector General produced a 400-page report about interrogation practices in Iraq, Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. That report was full of anecdotes by FBI officers who witnessed interrogations by US government and private intelligence contractors at detention camps, and it makes for very unpleasant reading. An Australian citizen, Mamdou Habib, was vindicated in one FBI account, which backed up Habib's claim that he was mistreated in two 15-hour interrogation sessions at Guantanamo Bay. Consultants love to use woolly jargon and to spin reality with soft-sounding words. Rendition for taking prisoners outside the American jurisdiction is a very good example. And there's been endless debate over the definition of the word torture. It's something the political satirists have had a field day with, This from John Stewart late last year.
Senior interrogation analyst, Mr. John Oliver, joins us now. John Oliver, let me ask you this. This is upsetting to me. The people, obviously, people love torture. How is fake drowning, sleep deprivation, how isn't that torture?
That is not torture.
Why?
Because we don't torture.
Meaning we don't do those things?
No. Meaning that if we do those things, they must not be torture.
That's insane.
Well, yeah. Isn't it great that we live in a country where you can say things like that? Yeah. That's really something. That's a bright day for America.
But, John, if it's not torture, what is it?
Enhanced interrogation.
So the prisoners...
Detainees.
Why aren't they prisoners?
Well, you can't torture prisoners, John. That's the Geneva Convention.
But a detainee...
That you could do. Yeah.
So waterboarding a prisoner...
Torture.
Waterboarding a detainee...
That's interrogation.
So words, in and of themselves, have no value.
Wow. I'd have thought you'd at least support our words, John.
I don't...
Our brave fighting words who've been serving this country since the War on Terror began. Many of them making the ultimate sacrifice, losing their definitions.
In America, so much money and energy was poured into intelligence services, public and private, since 9/11, the whole industry is staggering under its own weight. Enormous sums are involved, and hundreds of layers of spies, some of them spying on each other. Cost blowouts are a worry. The Senate Homeland Security Committee has a website with thousands of pages of information and the audio of committee hearings. Here is part of one testimony from early this year from the Federation of American Scientists, Dr. Stephen Aftergood.
The task of intelligence oversight has become significantly more difficult in recent years for at least two reasons. One is the enormous growth in the size of the intelligence budget. 10 years ago, the National Intelligence Program was spending on the order of $20 billion a year. Last year, the DNI disclosed the National Intelligence Program budget reached $43.5 billion. So intelligence spending on national intelligence has more than doubled.
That's more than $43 billion U.S. dollars. An enormous sum, and much of it has been spent on private intelligence contractors.
The spending on intelligence contractors has also doubled from 1996 to 2006. There are literally thousands of new contractual relationships between intelligence agencies and commercial entities that the intelligence oversight system is poorly equipped to regulate, oversee, or even verify that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Whatever they're doing, the companies that dominate intelligence contracting are hot property. As we've already mentioned, one of the biggest private equity buyouts so far this year is the Carlyle Group's purchase of the government services division of Booz Allen Hamilton. That buyout highlights the profits to be made in a sector that depends on political uncertainty. National security writer Patrick Keefe.
What's interesting is that some of the companies that have been involved in the private military context in Iraq have now been moving quite rapidly into the intelligence business as well. So Blackwater, for instance, has its own intelligence operation, which is kind of a sort of a nation product line, if you like, that they're pushing. And so that's been part of what's allowed for some context in which people can begin to discuss the privatization of intelligence. But that said, while the debate about private military contractors has been pretty robust, people are just now beginning to talk about the implications of an intelligence community that relies really increasingly on these private companies.
And the company that the intelligence community really relied on was Booz Allen Hamilton.
So if you look at a company like Booz Allen, Booz Allen, in fact, has been very involved in the intelligence community for years, going back far before 9/11. There was a former CIA official who once referred to Booz Allen as the shadow CIA, like another CIA. But what happened actually is if you look at Booz Allen, in the years since 2000, it's doubled its revenue. So this has been a kind of a boom time for these firms. And I think that even the fairly conservative estimates now put it at least 50% of the aggregate budget going toward private contracts.
You can read about some of these contracts, for example, Project Trailblazer for the National Security Agency, on Background Briefing's website. SAIC was the prime contractor for Trailblazer, and Booz Allen Hamilton was one of the many subcontractors. In the shadow of the big firms, there are many smaller companies doing a lot of creative research that has intelligence applications.
And I think that that's meant that for many, many small firms, it's created real opportunities, and people have basically thrown together startups with business plans and some new technology that they say will allow us to do automated translation or to do pattern recognition or data mining that they're peddling to the intelligence agencies. And for the big firms that have been in the business for a long time, for the Beltway Bandits, it's basically been an opportunity to start a whole new line of products and services. And in many instances, then, to acquire these smaller startup firms that actually make a name for themselves in whatever niche they've developed.
Patrick Keefe, now we come to the issue of open source information, which is a niche market in itself. Open source doesn't mean fiddling around on Google to see what can be found, but it does mean handling information that's not classified. It's collected using specialized research that can find all sorts of information from across the world and collate it and come up with an analysis of what's going on. It's done by some media companies such as the Economist Intelligence Unit for subscribers. Other small private companies do it too and sell their analysis in the form of specialist reports to governments. Because they're profit-driven, their reports have to be worth buying. And that can mean the contents have to be carefully scrutinized in case of beat-ups or misinformation. The big companies, known as the Beltway Bandits, are now moving into open source analysis too. The best of them can be very useful, says a private intelligence expert now at the University of Colorado. On the phone from his home in Boulder, Hamilton Bean.
How does the profit motive complicate what the intelligence community sees as its objective, which is to speak truth to power? How does that complicate that relationship? And in my experience, good news didn't sell services to government clients. So you get a kind of built-in structural impulse to try to hype national security threats in a way that makes your products more appealing. So you can already see this, a backlash, I think, to this in the Homeland Security sector, where you had dozens of Homeland Security information providers sending alerts and updates and emails to Homeland Security officials and emergency managers, law enforcement officials around the country. And many of those folks felt inundated by what they felt was worthless information that hyped threats in a way that was unhelpful to them and that they couldn't do anything about anyway.
All that worthless information that tumbled into government muddied the waters. Hamilton Bean said that back in 2002, the company he worked for tried to sell something to the Australian government and was knocked back.
I actually tried to pitch something called, I don't know if this entity still exists, but it's called the Australian Theatre Joint Intelligence Centre, the AFJIC. And there was a captain there who I tried to persuade to buy our services. I put the members of this organization on the distribution for our product, complimentary. And there was some interest in the service, but I think that the folks there got sticker shock when they realized how much it was going to cost them to maintain the service. And so we never actually signed the contract. But so there were American companies pitching Australian intelligence services back in 2002. It might interest some of your listeners.
What was being offered could have been a database or data mining software or analytical reports. Not everything may live up to the sales pitch, says Hamilton Bean.
When you start talking to analysts who are using these technologies or have been persuaded to try these technologies out, they find them lacking in a lot of ways. They don't do exactly what they were supposed to do. There's hidden costs to using the technology. For example, they'll say, well, we can glean all the information you want from certain websites. You just have to tell us the websites. Well, if the analysts knew what the websites were, they wouldn't necessarily need to have that technology. So there's kind of a contradiction in some of this stuff. And I think that folks really need to interrogate the claims that these companies make about their technologies and ask tough questions.
Over the past 5 or 6 years, intelligence analysts have been poring over the jihadist websites, trying to glean what their next move might be. If someone spots something considered important, it gets passed up the chain towards the White House, but each link of the chain might add or subtract their own bits and pieces. This is called herding.
Let me give you another example where this issue raises some problems, which is jihadi websites are obviously a really important source of intelligence information. You have a number of agencies employing people and probably private sector contractors as well, going on these websites, posing as normal people using these websites, trying to elicit information from folks. So if you're an intelligence contractor and you stumble upon one of these websites, you don't know whether the people that you're collecting information on these websites are in fact themselves government analysts or contractors trying to do the same thing you are. So you're kind of feeding misinformation or disinformation back into the system and be completely unaware of it.
What Hamilton Bean just described is now considered a serious intelligence risk by the US Congress. 2 weeks ago, the House Armed Services Committee warned of the dangers of open source intelligence collectors digging around in cyberspace. Knowing who is a good guy and who's a bad guy is difficult, and the security of networks could be compromised. The Director of National Intelligence in America is Michael McConnell, and he's responsible for coordinating all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. It's a very big and important job indeed, and McConnell says using private intelligence agencies to help is not a problem. Here at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York last year, Michael McConnell.
I'm not worried about the number of contractors or how the process works. Quite frankly, my response to that is thank goodness for the free market. Because if you find yourself in need of expertise, technical or analytical or in any dimension, the American free market can provide it. And the good news from my point of view as a manager inside government again is that when you no longer need that talent, you can turn it back and let it go work on something else. You haven't signed up for a lifetime commitment. So in my view, there's an ebb and flow with contractors that's very, very healthy. The system works, and it works pretty well.
Okay. Michael McConnell, the Director of National Intelligence in the U.S., had a chapter all to himself in the book Spies for Hire by Tim Shorrock.
Of course, I'm not surprised to hear him say that because he was with Booz Allen. He was the director, vice president, in charge of their military intelligence programs for about a dozen years. Before that, he was the director of the National Security Agency, so he went directly from a very senior level position in intelligence to this company. And in his job at the company, he was a key advisor to the NSA, to the agency he had left. And his company has played a role in some of the most sensitive operations conducted by the Bush administration.
Shorrock has an interesting nickname for Michael McConnell, the spy who came in from the boardroom.
I think if the expertise is with the private sector, you know, certainly you have to go there if that's the only place you can get it. Except I think that, you know, the basic problem is that companies answer to two masters. They're serving their government, as you know, their government is their client. At the same time, they serve their shareholders, and it's important to make a profit. And so I think those two things don't always work together.
The interplay between big business, big corporations, and government has been the stuff of novels and films and TV series for decades. Remember many years ago, the famous Manchurian Candidate, where the communist Chinese tried to get their own candidate into the White House using very sophisticated brainwashing. That film was recently remade with Denzel Washington. The Chinese communists have been replaced by a mysterious corporation that was loosely based on the Carlyle Group and Halliburton, a corporation that pioneered the concept of the private military corporation.
Mark.
Eleanor. Raymond, your granddad would be so goddamn proud of you.
Thank you, Mr. Wayne.
Raymond, this is J.B. Johnston from Manchurian Global.
Hi, how are you?
Pleasure.
And David Donovan, their managing director.
And co-chair of the U.S. International Policy Caucus.
Strong supporters, Congressman.
They're desperate to be of service to you, darling.
Thank you, Mother. I think you've earned your fee.
Oh, no. My plucky idealist.
So, gentlemen, how's business?
Not bad, Raymond. Business is not bad.
It could always be better.
Oh, any better? You guys are going to have more assets than the European Union.
Don't we already?
The modern U.S. spy thriller often ends with government officials appearing before congressional committees explaining what went wrong. The congressional committees have the power to investigate what government employees have stuffed up. Their roles and responsibility are covered under the laws of the land. But when it comes to private intelligence contractors, no one is quite sure. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd hasn't publicly addressed the specific issue of private intelligence companies, but in late April he did address the subtleties of government outsourcing in general.
As many private sector businesses have concluded, outsourcing can sometimes be a false economy because it can hollow out an organisation's important technical skills and know-how to its long-term detriment. Corporate memory is important, especially in government, and we should ensure that it's not diminished by short-term assessments of the costs and benefits of how we implement decisions and deliver services.
One of the key issues in the debate about privatisation of intelligence services is how do you test the quality of the product you're getting from the private sector? In Australia, one government-funded institution that was specifically set up to provide independent analysis on defence and security issues is ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. While ASPI is government-funded, it also gets money from other sources. One of its major corporate partners is Booz Allen Hamilton. A spokesman for Booz told Background Briefing that it was important for them to be visible and that their involvement at ASPI was mainly sponsorship of conferences and seminars where they could network with their clients. ASPI has also worked with Deloitte, a consulting firm which in the United States now has several ex-CIA and Homeland Security officials on its books. This year, Deloitte collaborated with ASPI to produce a special research paper on Homeland Security and the private sector. Executive Director of ASPI, Major General Peter Abigail.
Deloitte is a company that we knew had considerable experience in this field in the United States. And so we developed, and this is the only time we've ever done this, to my knowledge, we developed a collaborative approach where really we designed the project we wanted to do. And what Deloitte brought to the table was their quite deep experience, particularly US-based, and some other support to make the project happen. But again, in the end analysis, we always retain editorial control, intellectual property, and the determination of what goes into the product.
We raise with Major General Abigail the fact that there was scant reference to the debates in America about the role of private intelligence companies.
That just simply wasn't part of the framework of that particular research project. We were really looking more closely at the ways in which the United States solution, the connectivity between government departments and business enterprises at very high level was actually pursued. And that's where a senior member of Deloitte in Boston, I think he's based, heads up a business government council in the United States. And that was really the theme we were on about that. We weren't going into the issue of whether industry or business should actually step up and be a contracted player. We were looking at other issues like who pays. I mean, that's a topical issue around Australia. That's a different sort of line of reasoning that we were on from the one you're suggesting.
Major General Peter Abigail says they were merely trying to use Deloitte's expertise, not addressing the question over whether companies like Deloitte should be involved at all.
The paper was certainly not crafted to try and mask what might have been somebody else's agenda. we were looking to utilise the experience that Deloitte and the access that Deloitte can bring to bear in the United States, and the research for that paper involved a wide range of meetings with government industry players, both here in Australia and also in the United States. And it was really that access that that we got through through the Deloitte connection.
The Deloitte connection and the defence and security connections of its corporate sponsors puts ASPE in a difficult position. It leaves them open to the perception that the Chinese walls between public and private access to national intelligence are too thin. That concerns Peter Abigail.
It's something that's in the front of my mind on a continuing basis. And in that sense, our charter puts us in a rather difficult position. From where are you going to find other sources of funds? You know, there aren't that many places that a government-funded entity can go to. But we're alive to the issue, and that's why when we deal with these companies and set up our arrangements, it's made very, very clear that, one, we don't endorse any of their products. We won't do that. We won't pursue agendas. We won't act as an advocate or a lobby entity. We will retain intellectual property and total editorial control over everything we publish, and that we aren't there to be bought.
Major General Peter Abigail, Executive Director of ASPE. Anyone working in the area of intelligence and security has to be wary. Their analysis will influence politicians who have to ultimately decide who is friend or foe. Across the world, intelligence, whether government or private, is now pervasive and murky. In terms of money spent and money made, it's enormous. And because the potential profits to be made are so big, there's always the danger of someone putting a bit of marketing spin on some tidbit of information. An example might be someone who has submarines to sell. Dr. R.J. Hillhouse.
Well, let's say you've got pictures of Hainan Island in China and the southern tip of it, and you're not sure, but you think there might be a subsea base for new Chinese submarines. But it's not quite clear. Now, a corporation could, of course, spin that. You pressure your analysts in throughout the government, through in the defense intelligence, you do it in the CIA, you do it in, you know, whichever branch of it. So you could have lots of pieces of intelligence coming together. And then, of course, you also have people involved at the Office of Director of National Intelligence, where you could emphasize and the interpretation of that in a way that would make everyone be very concerned about that China is aggressively pursuing a attack submarine program. Now, I use that as an example because I believe that's what there have been some concerns over the last couple of weeks that the Chinese might have such a base at the south of Hainan Island. But that could affect Congress's willingness to fund, you know, long-term programs. So such a thing, I'm not saying that's happening at all, but theoretically it could be used to influence huge spending things. I mean, you could influence who your enemy is. When you control all aspects of the intelligence apparatus, from the gathering all the way to what goes to your end consumer, you know, you could make anything appear in any way you want to. That's what the business of espionage is all about.
Our coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research from Anna Whitfield. Technical production, Mark Don. Kirsten Garrett is our executive producer. I'm Stan Correy, and you're listening to ABC Radio National. This is Background Briefing. You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.